I'm Noah.
I'm Liam.
Liam from Oasis, and you're watching 120 Minutes.
Britpop. We're not Britpop. We're universal rock. That's what we are. We're not Britpop. The media can take the Britpop and stick it as far up the back entry of the country house as they can take it. We're a universal rock band. We're not Britpop.
Are you talking to any of those?
Because we're Irish for a start.
Oasis are being hyped as the best band around at the moment, but they do have a reputation for trashing hotel rooms. I wonder what this one's going to be like.
To say to somebody in 1993, where's guitar music going? They're not going to go, right, we want this fucking band from Manchester with a fucking singer who's 19, right, Larry, he's writing the songs, he's ripping off everybody who's fucking dead. The other three lads look like plumbers, you know.
There's quite a lot of people we'd like to thank, but we've paid you far too much money to come here and, shot your egos. I'd like to thank Ray Davis for influencing me. I'd like to thank George Martin for producing the best band ever was, the Beatles. I'd like to thank all our parents. Live forever. See you later.
If it goes number one, it goes number one. If it goes number 40, it goes number 40. I don't care. Because you know we're the best band on the planet. With the best songs.
His famous quote was, I reckon if we can get this album out before the Stone Roses come back, we'll sell 50,000.
All you need is cigarettes and alcohol.
So, Paul, Wayne, today is June 20th. The season has switched over. So let me be the first to wish you a happy Britpop summer.
Happy Britpop summer, Sepho.
I'm not saying that.
Well, okay, so here's why I call it that. This has got to be the most active time for bands that fall within that genre category since it happened in the early to mid 90s, right?
Yes.
So you have obviously Oasis reuniting, touring, new Pulp album just 2 weeks ago, and they were touring last year. They may have even been touring for 2 years now, right? Did they start in 2023?
It might have been 2022 actually.
Yeah, I mean they've been pretty active for a bit now. Obviously Blur was active last year, 2 years ago. They had the new record, and then obviously they did tours in the UK, and then I think they did some South American festivals and stuff. But I mean, that's a lot of action for kind of like the big three. If you want to add Suede in, kind of call it a big four.
And Supergrass is touring.
The Verve teased something. I don't even know if it was a tease, but you know how people are on social media.
Yeah, I think it was just like a rebooted website or something. It was not really anything exciting.
It's incredible. That's like going back to the 90s. We got a website. Cool.
Yeah, it's like, well, you know, I don't think the Verve is going to get back together. Ashcroft has dropped his just absolutely atrocious new single, and he's supporting Oasis, which, I mean, they're buddies, so I guess they kind of have to have him do it.
The caption, it kind of ended with, and who knows, maybe the song will be performed in front of thousands. And I think all the comments were like, oh my God, I would love for the Verve to get back together. But you're right. He's already got these shows booked, Ashcroft with Oasis. So that's probably what they were referring to, is he's just going to play it on those solo dates.
Speaking of Ashcroft's song that is atrocious, I don't remember who it was, but they said that they liked it. And it made me question our friendship.
It was one of your friends?
Yeah, somebody I was talking to recently in person, maybe at a bar or something.
And but you don't remember which song it was?
It's the new song that he dropped.
They said they liked the new song? Ooh.
Yeah. I was like, have you heard that song? And they were like, oh, yeah, it's pretty good. And I was like, no, it's not. It's atrocious.
Do you think it was one of those things where they thought you liked it? So they were just like, oh, yeah, no, that's good. And then you're just like, no, it's not.
That's making me worry about my usual taste. That's the case.
But look, I think we all saw Pulp last year, right? Wayne and I saw Blur last year. I don't think, do any of us have tickets to Oasis? I don't.
I do not.
No, tried for England and here and just gave up.
Do either of you think that you're going to peep tickets, kind of leading up to it and see if you can grab anything? I mean, I think they're going to be pretty pricey.
Told myself that I'll only go if somebody offers me a ticket for face value, which is probably unlikely, but you never know.
Well, I mean, Paul, did any of your buddies get tickets? Maybe it's a situation where someone ends up with an extra.
Yeah, I definitely have some friends going, and it could happen, but honestly, like, if it doesn't, I'm fine.
Yeah. Since we're on the topic, I think for me, look, I mean, it's been, I think, 16 years since they played their last show, 2009. We always knew that when they got back together, it was going to be a big deal. I personally don't think I felt like it was going to be as big of a deal as it is. I guess for some reason, I feel like the diehards were going to be excited for it, but I think the nostalgia factor has kicked in. Hey, it's hard to judge people and what their tastes are, but there are some people posting on social media that are like, oh, I got tickets. I was like, wow, you're an Oasis fan? I never would have pegged that. Of course, that's just going off of like their usual musical taste. So I don't know. It's me assuming a lot, saying that I didn't think they liked Oasis, but yeah, I don't know.
I think when I moved over here, 2004, and for me, for some reason, Oasis already felt done already, even like, so I hadn't been paying attention to them for a long time. After the first couple records, really. And then, of course, what was the third record? The Master Plan?
The Master Plan, yeah, I guess came out third before Be Here Now.
That's right. So, yeah, I mean, I was kind of already, I don't know, I'd already kind of moved on from Oasis at this point. So for me, and this is back to your point, Seth, it purely is like a nostalgia play. Like when they did reform, I got really excited because I was like, oh, it takes me back to the 90s when I was young and not in pain every day.
When I saw them last in 2009, I saw them on that final tour for Dig Out Your Soul. It was at the Staples Center, which is like a big, I guess, called Crypto Now. I mean, that's kind of one of the major stadiums in Los Angeles. So it's not like they were unpopular, but I really feel like they've kind of grabbed the attention of all sorts of folks right now. But you know what? Good for them. Do you guys think they're going to do anything past this tour? I mean, I feel like they've ruled out a new record. But what does that mean? You know, people change their mind all the time. And I think their manager even said, oh, well, this is going to, after this tour, that's it.
Yeah, but, well, and I think Liam kind of refuted that, but, you know, he says whatever he wants to say. And I mean, he was the one that was like, yeah, we've already recorded a new album. And when I saw that, I was like, wow. I mean, I was like, maybe they have, like, that's crazy. And then he was like, oh, no, just kidding. I'm like, what? All right. I found that annoying.
Really annoying.
Maybe it's just not trusting, you know, because I look at everything that people say around something like this, anything that's marketable, especially music. But I feel like it's like you can't really trust what anybody says. Like, it's weird because I think all the dates are mostly sold out. So part of me feels like, does the manager say that because he just wants to make sure that the shows fill out? But they're already sold out. Like,
but ultimately, you know, it's like if Noel says, let's do more shows or let's do an album, they'll do it. It's like it's purely his decision.
Yeah.
I mean, so I wouldn't be surprised if he was like, I'm going back to High Flying Birds after this. I mean, I would say the chances of them doing another album and like another tour probably.
So that made me just think of something. I was on the, you know, I kind of just visit the Oasis subreddit here and there to kind of see what people are saying. And apparently that last High Flying Birds tour with Garbage, I didn't go back and read what it was set. So this is all kind of hearsay to what whoever commented, but apparently they were saying that Noel, that was not a good experience for him.
Really?
Maybe it was because the shows weren't as well attended as they thought they were going to be. So that could have been at least part of the catalyst for them.
Well, so I went to the show in Chicago on that tour, and it was fantastic. I liked it a lot more than the last time I had seen them, which I guess was for the second album. What's it called? Chasing Yesterday?
Yeah.
So when I saw them for that tour, it was like just a rock band, you know, just playing loud guitar songs. And then when I saw them for Council Skies, it was like a lot more orchestrated, a much bigger band. And it seemed like Noel was having a lot better time. He seemed to be having a great time at the gig that I saw. He was seemed very happy, and it sounded amazing. And I thought it was great. I mean, I don't like garbage. I thought that was a weird pairing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was like, I don't think this is the right band for them to be touring the States with.
Yeah, but I think it was like a 90s nostalgia play, right?
Yeah,
like two big radio bands in the 90s.
Was that a co-headline?
It was. I think they were like alternating headlining slots, because when I at the gig I saw, Garbage played first.
Got it.
Paul, do you remember, was it pretty well attended, or were there?
Yeah, it was really packed. It was an outdoor venue, Northerly Island. I'd never been there before, but it was a great venue, and it sounded awesome, and it was really full.
Okay, so maybe it's bullshit, right? Like, I mean, like I said, I mean, people just say stuff.
I mean, it's possible that some of the dates were undersold. I mean, you know, I don't know what other cities were on the tour. Like, I could see, you know, maybe Atlanta or whatever, you know, I could see some of the smaller, you know, stops not doing as well, but that's kind of the par for the course. I mean, I don't know. All I have to base my comments on are the one show I went to.
Yeah. I mean, to your point, maybe he was just bummed that he had to play with Garbage. Cause you're right. I mean, that's not, don't really see those two bands as being similar other than just two bands that were all over 90s rock radio, right?
Yeah.
I feel like he'd kind of say over who he's touring with, though. It's not like he's a small up-and-coming act, even though
But the one thing I will say is the times that I saw High Flying Birds, they certainly weren't playing a place like Crypto or Staple. You know what I mean? Like, they were definitely smaller venues. So it's interesting because, you know, all the Noel stuff is really, I love all the solo stuff. And he plays a bunch of Oasis. At least he did when I saw him, the two times I saw the High Flying Birds. I don't know if you saw him on Council Skies, Paul. I don't know if he was playing more High Flying Birds at that point.
I think he's pretty much always ended the show with like four or five Oasis songs. Yeah. I mean, I think it's always pretty much been, which, you know, I mean, he threw in like a weirdo B-side, Going Nowhere, kind of in the middle of the set, which I never really liked that song a ton, but like it came off real well live. And that was an interesting choice to do. And then, you know, at the end, I'm pretty sure it was like Live Forever, Don't Look Back in Anger. I can't remember what else.
Did you do Champagne Supernova?
I
want to say he may have done, I don't know. I'd have to go back and look at the set list for the shows I went to. All right, well, we could jump into this. So, you know, essentially this is the idea behind this is we're going to dedicate one episode for each Oasis record, including the B-sides record, The Master Plan. You know, if we have fun with it, I think we can kind of decide if we want to do some tangent episode, kind of go off the beaten path and do the High Flying Birds records, maybe some BDI. I think Paul's really excited if we chatted about it.
I don't have anything to say about that.
And then in the grand scheme of things, in the master plan, if you will, if we remain focused on this, I mean, I would love, and we have fun, I would love to do Blur, Pulp, Sway, and you kind of pick different bands of the era. So that's the intention, but, you know, let's just proceed and see how we feel about it.
It would have been good to start with a band that I already didn't say that I fell off after the first two records.
No, actually.
Well,
okay.
I think it would be fun to do an episode that was like, all right, we're going to cover the last, I mean, maybe you could do one. You could do a whole episode on Morning Glory. You could do, I mean, probably lump The Master Plan and Be Here Now together. And then you could do one on the rest of the albums.
Yeah. But, you know, actually, so Wayne, you're saying that you fell off after the second record. So does that mean you're not very familiar with the material on Standing on the Shoulders of Giants or Don't Believe the Truth? Yeah, you know, that record at all?
That would have been just singles that I would know from those.
So, Paul, that would actually be interesting to kind of have Wayne, because, you know, obviously you and I know
yeah,
those records really
I think
well.
It would be cool to have Wayne, like, listen. I mean, maybe depending on how it goes, like, we could do, like, all right, we're going to do Standing on the Shoulder, and then what came after that one? Don't Believe the Truth?
Yeah.
Maybe we could do those two, and then we could do the last two.
Yeah, Heathen Chemistry. And
like
then
Wayne could listen to them, and like he would have a fresh perspective that wasn't really. Well, yeah, he would have a different perspective than us, in that he would have like not, he just wouldn't be familiar with the records when they came out, you know.
Well, you know what's funny about that is, Paul, you and I have talked about those records, I think, quite a bit. I mean, I don't know if quite a bit's the right term, but I know we've discussed each of those records over the years at different stages, but there is some good material there. I mean, I would even go as far as to say there's some great material there. So it would be fun to see Wayne kind of experience those and see if he kind of, if we can win him over on a couple of those records, you know?
I'm in. I'm down to listen to him for sure.
Well, all right, so, you know, just broad strokes about Definitely Maybe. Obviously, it's their debut record, released on August 29th, 1994, on Creation Records. Was it Sony in the United States? Columbia? I forget.
I think it was Sony.
Yeah, I think you're right. Number one on the UK charts, hit number one in the first week. It achieved the fastest selling debut in British music history and held that title until, does anyone have a guess as to who wrote
that
record?
Yeah, I saw this and I wanted to just jump in and say the Spice Girls, perhaps?
No. Think early 2000s, like 2004, I think.
Damn, right. I have no idea. I figured it would be a short-lived like record.
No, I think it was about, they held the record for about 10 years-ish, but it was the Arctic Monkeys. They broke the record with.
For the fastest selling debut?
Yeah.
Makes sense.
That's crazy. It doesn't make sense to me, but.
Well, so remember the blogosphere and how bands would just take off? But do you guys remember Tapes and Tapes, which is a band I don't even think, are they even exist anymore? But if you read the blogs back in the early 2000s, you would think that band was the biggest band on the planet. Everyone. And I think the same thing with Arctic Monkeys, although being an Arctic Monkeys fan, I feel like the hype was warranted. And obviously they've kind of gone on and proved that with, you know, now they're playing stadiums at this point. So it didn't. So the record only hit the number 58 on the US Billboard chart. It did hit number one on something called the Heat Seekers, which they don't really monitor that anymore. But essentially what Heat Seekers was, it was just a chart that kind of tracked new and developing bands. And of course, this is all based on Nielsen SoundScan. So like it's kind of when it was rung up at the register, it would kind of report back. So, you know, I don't know how, I feel like there's probably some data that gets lost along the way, but probably pretty true. Like, I don't think that record would have been number one, at least from my, and we can kind of get into this in a second, but from my perspective and where I was, certainly Live Forever was everywhere, but I don't know, at least in my small town in central New York, I didn't really get any of those singles before that, right? Now, Paul, you probably did only because you're a little older and you were probably seeking out new and interesting music, where I was kind of just beholden to, you know, whatever was kind of playing on the radio in my little town.
Yeah, I can speak to that. I do want to talk to, like, you know, the singles, like, and before Definitely Maybe came out, because I have specific memories of that. So I mean, at the time I was reading like Melody Maker and Enemy and Select and Vox. I don't know if you guys remember those magazines, but all the British magazines. And so, yeah, Oasis was like on my radar, because all of a sudden it was like, this is a band that everybody's excited about in the UK, but like it was really hard to access the music. But then Select put out an issue and it had a cassette, and it had like a demo version of Fade Away on it. I'm pretty sure I do not have that cassette anymore, but it was like an early version of that song. And that was the first song I heard. And I was like, this guy's voice is weird, but it had something. I remember being like, yeah, okay. And then I was in Chicago for some reason, and there was this bookstore / record store called, I think it was Earwax, and they had a used copy of the Shaker Maker single. And that was very exciting, because it was like, you know, it was just hard to get this stuff. And I just, and it was used, and I was like, wow, okay. So I bought that. And honestly, like, I don't love that single. I mean, it's got Do You Want to Be a Spaceman on it? And like, I can't even remember what the other B-sides are. I thought the whole thing was just like, okay. But like, you know, Shaker Maker has that Coca-Cola commercial melody to it, which is all I've, you know, I always thought, even back then when it came out, I was like, this is a little corny. But I remember that. I remember reading a review of the Live Forever single and probably Select. And then I couldn't hear that. So I didn't hear that song until it came out, the album came out. But then I remember when the album came out, and I went to the record store, like 30 minutes from my hometown, to get it. And they had one copy on CD. So that's like my recollection of kind of the lead up to the release of the record.
Wow, one copy. That's insane. And you got the one copy. No one else was in line for it or anything.
There wasn't a line. I mean, I just went like, I think I went, I mean, back in the day, what was it? Like, it was like Tuesdays, I think, that records came out.
Yeah, Tuesday drop dates.
And
yeah.
I can't remember if I went. I might have gone on the day of release, because I knew I really wanted it. I probably did go, but it would have been like, I don't know, after school somehow I went, got there. And yeah, they had one copy.
Were any of your friends at the time of the same mind as you, kind of seeking out new music? And I guess my question is, was Oasis on their radar too? Or did you feel like it was just kind of you who knew about the band from your group?
I think there was maybe a couple other friends that were vaguely aware of them, but I think I was probably the most enthusiastic about it. That's not to say that I was like the only one in my school, so to speak, but there were definitely not a lot of people like on that wavelength, because it was pretty niche, you know, like there weren't a lot of kids that were into that kind of stuff in my high school.
So I'm sorry, I didn't hear, did you mention Supersonic? Because that was actually the lead single.
Oh yeah, yeah, Supersonic. So I think I did get that single at some point, but the first one I got was Shaker Maker. I mean, it's possible that I heard Supersonic before Shaker Maker, but I don't think I did. I think I heard the Fade Away demo on that cassette, and then I'm pretty sure the next thing I heard was the Shaker Maker single, because I found that used copy. I don't really remember when I heard Shaker Maker for the first, or Supersonic for the first time. Which is kind of weird. I should, but
were these songs being, I mean, I'm assuming back then, I mean, I only had the radio. There wasn't blogs. Like, the internet was still becoming a thing. You know, it was certainly around, but you know, you had to have access to it. And I don't even know if there were music sites per se back then. Were they playing these songs on the radio?
There was no internet it wasn't until I was a senior in high school, which would have been, you know, 1995, when the internet even became like vaguely a thing. So like when Definitely Maybe came out, it was definitely, it was pre-internet. At least it was for me. I don't think anybody really had access. So like, I don't remember hearing any of their songs on the radio until after they started to take off after the album came out. For sure, none of the singles I heard on the radio. I don't remember seeing any videos on MTV. Even like, do you guys remember Alternative Nation? Is that what it was called?
Yeah.
Was that the, yeah, that was like the late night MTV where they play indie stuff. Every once in a while, you would catch something really cool on there, like a Verve song or something. But I don't remember seeing Oasis on there.
I'll go next only because my story is pretty short. So obviously when Live Forever came out, I was 14 in 1994 when this record came out. Still pretty squarely into metal as kind of my main genre. But I feel like when Live Forever came out, it was such a hit with such a force, at least in my little town in upstate New York, that it was basically unavoidable. So I knew about Oasis. I didn't go out and buy the record at the time. I think I was still just had my head in a different place. And, you know, I feel like kids in my school, I would kind of start seeing Oasis shirts pop up. So I was starting to build awareness about them at that time, but I certainly wasn't, I wouldn't call myself a fan. But I would love to throw it over to Wayne only because you were in England at the time. And I'd love to kind of hear, obviously you were younger, right? Were you nine?
I was nine when Supersonic dropped as the single, and I was 10 by the time the album came out. I don't remember the singles like dropping. I mean, I was too young, I think, to really connect with it. I might have heard them on the radio and whatnot. So yeah, I mean, the first song I remember from the record is actually Shaker Maker, and it's because of the music video. Where they're all playing football and it just looked like a normal park where you just play football and have a kick around. And Greg Z's like heading the ball and he's got his motorbike helmet on and stuff. And it was like goofy and fun. And so that's where I first sort of connected with them. And then the subsequent songs I heard were like Supersonic, Live Forever. So yeah, it was definitely a weird thing for me because my sisters who are older than me, they didn't really seem to be too into it. And then my brothers, who were always older than me, didn't live with us. So I didn't have his influence, which was kind of how I found out about cooler music when I was a kid. So yeah, Shaker Maker came on MTV and I would watch that for music videos. I just liked music videos when I was a kid. And yeah, that's where I first heard them.
So, and I know it's hard because I'm thinking when I was 10, I don't know that I noticed any, for lack of a better term, buzz. Although I guess I did, you know, obviously, again, going back to kind of like being into metal, Metallica was everywhere. I definitely knew about the buzz around Metallica in 1991. Guns N' Roses, you couldn't really get away from. And then obviously Nirvana. But you kind of being closer to the epicenter, did it feel like they were everywhere at that time, or was it more of just like you were kind of doing your stuff at being 10 and you happened to kind of see Shaker Maker on MTV and then that was...
Yeah, for me, it was just happening upon it. Like, I mean, I grew up in a really small village as well, so I was surrounded by kids who were my age. I mean, there were 5 kids in my grade class in school. So I was like, this is how isolating it was. And then it was like old people. And I say that as my parents were like younger than I am now. Like, so it's kind of weird. But yeah, there wasn't anything like no venues. Pubs were just quiet places for old dudes to drink. So I didn't have that kind of thing on me. The way I found out about music is a lot like you, Seth, with just radio and MTV.
Yeah, I mean, so our own personal experiences aside, you know, just kind of going back and understanding what the release of this record did for them. I mean, they were massive, right? Like this record came out. I mean, obviously a record that hits number one in, you know, in the UK is like were they superstars right away? I mean, I feel like maybe not superstars because I know they were probably still playing the smaller venues, although I feel like they were booked at Glastonbury and a few other festivals.
think they were at Glastonbury that year, or maybe the following. But yeah, I know what you're getting at. And I do think that they were, I think it was the attitude of Liam that kind of helped propel them, because he was always like in the news, like from day one, or saying something completely outlandish and weird. And so I think that, yeah, they were everywhere because of that. And then it's almost like the music was secondary to who he was.
Well, I mean, if we want to focus on the music for a second, I mean, would you guys agree that if we're looking at it from a global perspective, that Oasis was the biggest band of that era? Now, I'm not talking about the UK, because I know in the UK, you know, everyone knows about the Blur versus Oasis thing, and, you know, that whole, and, you know, obviously Pulp, when they played Glastonbury and took over for the Stone Roses slot when Stone Roses dropped out, that was kind of like a star-making performance. I know they were big, but like, I think, would you guys agree with that or disagree that, you know, not taking our personal taste into account, but just looking at it from like a rock or a music history standpoint, would you say that Oasis is kind of the band that people think about first when they think about Britpop?
Yes.
Yeah, 100%.
I was doing some thinking about why that might be. Obviously, the music's good. It's great. The songs are really catchy. I think I don't know if I want to use the word everyman, but like, they're singing about being a rock and roll star, right? You know, like, I think from like a bravado standpoint, they really planted that flag. And, you know, I think Blur and Pulp, they kind of had different themes that they were writing about and singing about, and they went about it in, I mean, I don't want to call the Oasis music remedial by any stretch, but is it a little simpler than a Pulp or a Blur? Like, I think it's kind of anthemic, you know, there's some power chords there. It's just, I don't know if simpler is the right word.
Yeah, like by definition, I would say that the Oasis songs are simpler than Blur songs. Like if you just look at the chords and the progressions and stuff, they're a lot simpler. I mean, like if you can look at the booklet for Modern Life is Rubbish and it has all the chords, you know, written in it, they're just more complicated songs. So yeah, I would say the Oasis stuff is just way easier for an average person to connect to.
Also, like it with Oasis, there was no pretense or there's nothing. It was a what you see is what you get kind of thing for them. And I think it was really easy to connect to them, especially as like working class kid. Like I could totally understand these sort of young guys drinking their lager and wanting to be the rock and roll star kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, opening the record with Rock and Roll Star is quite the statement. But I mean, just kind of looking over the rest of the songs on the record, Live Forever, you know, I think obviously Cigarettes and Alcohol, I think, is something that, you know, people at the pub or whatever would really respond well to. It's like, yeah, fuck yeah, Cigarettes and Alcohol. So I felt like it was, I guess maybe the word I'm looking for is a very direct approach to living life in like a happy way, I guess, you know, and when you kind of contrast it with the other genre at the time that was really popular, grunge, you know, obviously that was, you know, it was darker music. A lot of it was depressive, you know, obviously, you know, a lot of it was in Seattle and you kind of had like the gloomy weather and the kind of the heroin use and stuff like that. It was definitely like, you know, down in a hole to reference the Alice in Chains song. So I feel like this was the flip side.
I feel like Oasis was that sort of band that could come into the charts and be way better than, like, I'm just looking this up now. Fucking Wet, 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 Love Is All Around from Four Weddings and a Funeral. That was number one for fucking ages. I remember it was just always playing. And I think it was like number one for 17 weeks or something. So you hearing this dreadful song is just garbage. And then you know, the Oasis singles come out and then Oasis have this swagger. That's way fucking better than, like, who else? Wigfield, Saturday Night, which is like a club bop anthem. I think the commercial stuff in that era was not good.
Yeah, I mean, I think your experience is, like, a lot different than mine and Seth's, because you were living there. It's like, I don't even, maybe I would recognize that Wet, Wet, Wet song, but it doesn't ring any bells.
Yeah, you would know that one. I mean, Celine Dion was up there with Baby Think Twice.
Sure.
Prince.
I mean, like, Live Forever is just, like, such an uplifting song. You know, I can imagine people singing along with it in a bar, which I never experienced that. But, like, I mean, I'm sure that that happened all the time.
I mean, that is just a great song, though, at the same time.
Well, I mean, Supersonic is similarly, like, a song that I can see people, and even Cigarettes and Alcohol as well, you know. I mean, all three of those songs, I could just can picture in a British pub, like, them coming on and just everybody knowing all the words.
Yeah, I mean, if I weren't 10 at the time, I'd agree.
I get it. Well, I wasn't, you know, I was older than you, but I wasn't old enough to, you know, I wasn't even out of high school, so...
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that you said that you started seeing people with Oasis t-shirts around the time that the first album came out, because I had one that I bought at that first gig I went to, but, like, I was definitely, like, the only nerd in my class that, and, like, I don't know how many kids you were in your class, and, well, you were younger than I am, so, I mean, there had to have been at least a couple hundred kids in my class in high school. I never saw anybody else wearing an Oasis t-shirt around the time of the first album.
Well, actually, I mean, you bring up a great point. You know, when you're that age and we're so many couple decades removed from that time, I think years can bleed together. And, you know, What's the Story, Morning Glory came out in 95. So, yeah, to your point, I think if I was seeing Oasis shirts, I would probably guess that it was for the second record, for Morning Glory versus Definitely Maybe, you know, because I think there was a buildup to the fan base, especially in the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, I don't know if we want to talk about this, but I do remember seeing them for Morning Glory and they were playing like a large theater. So they definitely were playing bigger venues. But, like, I would imagine in England, they were, I mean, what was their, like, big show that they did in the UK for the first album? Did they do, like, a huge...
Was that like, the Manchester City ground?
I don't know, but surely they had, like, a really big show, I would think. But maybe that didn't happen until the second album. I don't know.
I want to say you're right. I feel like it was the first record. They
played.
Well,
I feel like when you think about... Oh, Hedwin?
Sorry, they played Main Road, I think, then.
Yeah, that sounds familiar,
that was 1996. Yeah, okay, no, second, you're right.
Yeah, I don't know. I can imagine that they were playing pretty big shows, like, after Definitely Maybe hit number one in the UK, but that was the nice thing about seeing them here is that you could see them in a tiny venue, so I was able to see them twice in small.
Going back to the grunge thing for a minute, only because being a fan of the Britpop genre for so long, I feel like I have heard different people talk about how Britpop was the answer, like the UK's answer to grunge, right? Because they, you know, even if you look at Blur's and Pulp's and, you know, Suede songs, like, I think it was a different gear, right? Like, it wasn't, they're just two different types of music. So, I mean, in the spirit of, like, getting ready to do this chat, you know, it's like you think you kind of know a lot of stuff about a record and how it was recorded. But one thing that I found when I was just kind of reading about stuff is I was reading that Supersonic, Noel was inspired by Nirvana for that song. Do you guys know about this?
No.
So I was reading, it says, as with Bring It On Down, the power chord sequence of Supersonic is heavily influenced by Nirvana's Nevermind. And of course, you know, when you read these things on the internet and you're just like, I got to check that source out. So I found an interview with Noel. And, you know, this was this was from 2017 that he said this. So I think at the time, I feel like, I don't know, I just got the sense that like grunge was not a thing that they would have admitted to liking. I could be wrong, but here's what Noel said about Kurt Cobain in 2017. I always had an affinity with him because he was left-handed, he had blue eyes, he was a Gemini, and he was into the Beatles, and that's what I was, so I was like, fucking hell. And then he goes on to say, Mark Coyle, who co-produced Definitely Maybe at the time, he was also doing monitors for Teenage Fan Club when they went on their tour with Nirvana. I said, what's he like? And he said, you'd fucking love him. He's great. He's crazy as fuck, but he's great. Then I remember signing for Creation and meeting Teenage Fan Club and them saying he's a really fucking cool guy. So, I don't know. I found that an interesting tidbit. You know, I think you kind of take the information that you know about an artist and you know, maybe you make some assumptions that are incorrect. I mean, I know you do. I know I do. But I did find that as a bit of a surprise that, number one, he was influenced or allegedly influenced by Nirvana for this first record. And then second, at least according to him in an interview from 2017, he, I don't want to say that, not idolized, but he definitely had a large measure of respect for him. And I guess he was a fan, sounded like. So I don't know. I thought that was an interesting thing.
It's weird because I feel like that whole movement in England kind of was the counter to grunge.
I'm pretty sure if you dug deep, you could find quotes that were like anti-grunge, that like, we're not into this depressing American stuff, which I'm sure you could find examples of that. But, you know, contradictions are not out of the ordinary for those guys.
It's so true. Yeah, I mean, let me see if I can find it, because I did read something about, so again, I don't know what year this was. I don't know if it was when the record had come out or if this was kind of like a quote from later on, but Noel was talking about how Nirvana had that song, I Hate Myself and I Want to Die.
Yes, I remember that.
Yeah, Live Forever was like his didn't say it was a response, but he's like, that was his, he's like, look, you know, you're rich, you're a rock star. Yeah. And this is kind of like a young person's thing to say in your early 20s, right? Because like, I mean, I think we all know now that like Kurt Cobain was a pretty tortured person, both physically, his physical health and drug abuse. But, you know, I think at the time you could be like, you'd forgive him for being like, well, what the fuck, dude? Like, you're on top of the world. You're playing, you're touring the world and you're playing massive arenas and you're still bummed out enough to write a song like that. So Live Forever was kind of like, you know, the opposite of that, right? I mean,
I kind of doubt it was an exact, like it was a specifically a response, because that Nirvana song was like a pretty obscure B-side.
Yes.
I kind of doubt that Noel was, I mean, I doubt that he was familiar with that track when he wrote Live Forever, but maybe I'm wrong.
Yeah. Yep. Let's see, what else do we have here? I mean, where would you guys put this record in the, just kind of in the pantheon of the Britpop genre? Because to me, I mean, it's Oasis's debut, had massive singles, kind of made them, you know, one of the biggest, certainly one of the biggest, if not the biggest rock band in the UK. And then like starting to kind of reach out globally into other, you know, it was basically their announcement of like, we're here, you know, and we're, you know, we're amazing. You know, they were always very like, you know, definitely not a lack of confidence. They were always like, we're the best band in the world and stuff like that. I mean, where would you guys put this against, you know, A Modern Life is Rubbish or Different Class or, you know, just kind of general Britpop records?
It's Wayne and I were talking about this a little bit before you jumped on. It's just really hard for me to think about these albums, quote unquote, within the pantheon of Britpop. I just think of them as records and like, yeah, I can't think within the pantheon of Britpop. It just doesn't make any sense to me. because then you start comparing albums that don't sound anything like each other. You know, it's like how can you compare definitely maybe to the first or second Suede album? It doesn't make any sense. That was like a thing that I was going to mention earlier on. And sorry if I'm sidetracking, but like going back to like the directness of the songs on Definitely Maybe. I remember when I first heard Suede and Metal Mickey was the first song I heard by them. And I was like, and I loved it. I was like, this is really exciting. But I was like, I have no fucking clue what this song is about. Like the lyrics are very like kind of dark and obscure. And it's like, I'm sure that there are specific, you know, English terms in there that I wasn't familiar with. It just wasn't clear. But with the Oasis stuff, it was like, yeah, it was so obvious, you know, what the songs are about. So I guess like what I'm getting at is it's like, it's hard for me to say like, well, this is where I place the album, you know, in terms of Britpop in general. That's just not how my brain works. So I don't know, like I'm going to throw it to Wayne and see what he has to say.
Thanks, Paul, for that impossible to follow setup. I mean, if I'm going to rank it as just a standalone part of that whole movement, I mean, it's got to be a top 10 of all of the things that came in Britpop, I would think. I don't think it's as good as Modern Life is Rubbish. I don't think it's as good as Park Life. I don't think it's as good as Dogman Star. I don't think it's like, it's not as good as Different Class, but it's up there. Like, it's good because of what you said earlier, Seth. It's really direct. And it, I don't know, but it, for me, it's not like, oh, I'm going to make this my number one on my favorite Brit records of the 90s.
That makes sense. Like, kind of agree that it's not, I mean, I would say I think I like Modern Life is Rubbish better, but like, Definitely Maybe it's just its own unique entity. I mean, just the sound of that record is so insane, you know, like it's kind of hard to listen to just the way it's brick walled, but it's like it works, you know. Yeah, I mean, I guess I would agree it's in the top 10, probably top 5, I guess, if you had to rank them.
Yeah, and I know that ranking is just like, it's an impossible task, but I think, you know, Paul, what you said, I think, puts this in I kind of look at it in a different context because, and, you know, sorry to kind of keep going back to grunge, but I remember, you know, grunge bands saying, you know, we were all lumped into this category because we were from the same area, right? And, you know, I think the point was, it's like, you know, Nirvana sounds a lot different than Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and now, you know, Screaming Trees. If we're looking at the genre,
let me interject here real quick, though. I would argue that those bands, Pearl Jam, Nirvana, Screaming Trees, like Soundgarden, they have more of a thread going through them that ties them together than the Britpop bands. Like, they all have this kind of sludgy, heavy guitars. The vocals have similarities. I mean, I think that those bands sonically have a lot more in common than Oasis, Blur, Suede, Pulp, Supergrass. Does that make sense? Do you agree?
Yeah, no, I think I do. But, you know, I think if I listen to a Pearl Jam song next to a Nirvana song, it's like, if you were like just someone who didn't know that this was the same, this was under the umbrella of grunge, right? I mean, they're kind of two different sounds. I mean, they do share similarities. You're right.
I think Nirvana are the ones, though, here that are the outlier. Like, you could listen to any of those bands next to Nirvana and you could be like, yeah, that's different. But like, I'd also, if I were to be on the side of defending grunge, I'd also include Mudhoney as a different one. Grunge Truck, of course.
Yeah, of course. No, but it makes me think about Britpop, and Paul, you kind of just mentioned it, is like, you know, other than these bands being from UK, and I guess, for lack of a better way of putting it, having melody, upbeat melodies to their, you know, I don't, so Pulp sounds different from Oasis, sounds different from Blur, sounds different from Suede, sounds different from Elastica. You know what I mean? It's just, they are all different bands that stand on their own, their catalogs stand on their own. But, you know, I think it's kind of going back to that, I don't know. I blame marketing. I feel like they have to put labels on stuff. But
yeah, same time, I mean, it's music journalism, you know, like I think I was saying to Wayne earlier that it's more of a time and a place than it is really quite what they sound like.
I would also say like Britpop has more of a social commentary aspect to it. Like all the bands that we've talked about in that time and place, they sing about the circumstances around them. They sing about the things that people do around them and just the world around them. But it's very much focused on the region, right? It's not just, and I'm going to sound like a grunge idiot because I don't know much about it, but if I think of Soundgarden, I think it's this really broad existential songwriting. And I also think that about Nirvana as well. It doesn't feel like specific to the neighbors or the guys at the pub or the kids in the park, you know?
That
like,
makes sense. That's insightful. I agree. That makes sense.
You know, I think the last thing I'll say about it is, you know, I don't mean to bag on journalists or people who are talking about these genres during their time of being kind of at the apex. But, you know, I mean, look, if 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 bands are like popping and really kind of becoming popular at the same time from the same area, that's kind of a movement, right? Like whether you kind of want to be like, yeah, those should all be labeled this or that, you know, you could debate that. But, you know, Britpop was definitely a movement and grunge the same way, you know, it was a time and a place, and neither one of those could really be denied as far as the kind of general music listening public flocking to both, you know. You know, I think we're kind of wrapping up, although, you know, I'll kind of throw it over to you guys if you want to say anything else. But yeah, here's another thing that I thought was interesting. Hold on, I'm trying to find the notes. Just in the realm of like kind of discovering things that it's like, oh, you think you know everything about a band or a record or whatever. I didn't realize that on the cover of Definitely Maybe, there's a photograph of a Manchester United player, George Best. And that was at the request of Bonehead, which obviously, you know, we know the Gallagher brothers are big City fans. So I'm trying to figure out how they allowed a Manchester. I mean, maybe they were just maybe a little more agreeable back then and go with the flow. But I don't know. I can't see them at any other point in the history of that band allowing a United player on their album artwork.
Wayne? I think for how stubborn they are, they might recognize the absolute class of George Best, at least. They know their football, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a good point.
I didn't realize George Best was on there. I literally never noticed.
Yeah, he's on there.
He is. He's in his Ireland kit. Yeah, what the hell?
Yeah, probably why they... I mean, how long was Bonehead with the... I guess he was there for Definitely Maybe, right? But, I mean, I figure, is that one of the reasons why they couldn't deal with him anymore? Because he's talking about United so much? Maybe they kind of were at loggerheads there.
But now he's back. Old.
I think that it would be... I think we should talk a little bit more about some of the deeper cuts. Like, I actually just pulled my CD singles for the 4 singles from the record.
Yeah. Well, what do you got, Paul?
So, like, I think it's important to touch on, like, the importance of the B-sides, because even for the first album, like, they were pretty great. I mean, so the Supersonic single, I don't really think much of the B-sides, which are Take Me Away and then a live version of I Will Believe, which I don't even remember how that goes. And then there's a demo of Columbia, which is obviously a cool song. So this is the Shaker Maker single, which I bought used. And I will say there's a price tag on the Supersonic single at $8.99, which is pretty absurd. That's a lot of money to spend for 4 songs in 1994.
Well, it was an import, right?
It's an import, yes. But anyways, so, okay. So, but I think with the second or the third and fourth singles is where things really get interesting, because Live Forever, which... the cover art is, you guys know what it is, Seth?
No, I mean, I'm familiar with the cover art, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's like John Lennon's childhood home, I believe. I'm fairly confident that that's what it is. Okay, so this, the B-sides to this are Up in the Sky, an acoustic version, and then Cloudburst, which is, I think Cloudburst is a really cool song. And there's a live version of Supersonic, but Cloudburst is really cool. And then Cigarettes and Alcohol has I'm a Walrus, which we haven't talked about that. Listen Up and Fade Away, those two songs are fantastic. I love the recording of Listen Up is so insane. It's like, it's so raw, and I think it sounds like amazing. I think that that song probably was recorded after they put out the album, but it probably should have been on the album. Listen Up, Fade Away, I love those two songs. Like, probably as much as the material on the album. There's definitely some songs on the album that I like these songs better. And the live version of I'm a Walrus, which is from, like, says Glasgow Cat House, June 94, is, like, pretty crazy. Anyway, it was cool that they put Fade Away on this because that was, like I said, the first Oasis song I ever heard, but it was, like, a demo version. So, you know, I really, back in the day when I was buying these, it was exciting to, like, get the B-sides.
I don't think I know any of those ones. Maybe Fade Away.
You probably know that. I mean, so you're not familiar with the master plan, Wayne?
Not particularly.
Yeah, okay. So, Paul, I'm glad that you brought this up, because the B-sides for Oasis are important to talk about, mainly because there are a few bands where the B-sides are right up there with the album tracks, right? Like Oasis is one of those bands. I think The Cure is one of those bands. At least for me, The Cure was one of those bands where, like, their B-sides in the 80s and the 90s were just like, you think of B-sides and you think they're kind of like, I guess, for, you know, throwaway tracks or like deemed not good enough for the actual album release. But I think for Oasis specifically, they were just writing so many amazing songs that, you know, short of releasing a double album for their debut, you know, like they couldn't put them all on one record. So therefore you just had all these amazing songs that didn't make it, you know? So, you know, they just released them as the B-sides. I'm trying to think of what was the first B-side you mentioned? I can look too.
You mean on Supersonic? Take Me Away.
So you said you don't really like that song, huh?
I can't even think of how it goes, to be honest.
Take me away, because I just don't want.
Yeah, okay.
That's good. It's got
it's a catchy song.
You know, that actually reminded me of something else that I read. Because, yeah, look, I mean, we all know that the lyrics for Oasis are, you know, look, if you're just reading them, right, you don't know the music, you don't know the melody. Yeah, you know, the lyrics aren't. They don't really stand the strongest, especially if you're kind of thinking of across the genre and different bands and stuff. And I found an interesting quote about Noel, which I agree wholeheartedly. And Paul, you and I think when we talk with Ben, and Ben shits on the lyrics when we bring up Oasis, and I think maybe Wayne does a little bit. But I think if you take lyrics that on their own are probably like a C+, but you kind of like pair them with a melody or like a song that's like A++, then, you know, the lyrics kind of become amazing just because they're associated with that melody. So I read this, I think this sums it up. Noel said, "It's usually lyricists that will tell you that the words are fucking everything. They are not. The words don't mean shit to anybody. It's the melody is what you remember. We all whistle tunes. It's always about the melody, and that's what I do." Which, as a blanket statement for all of music, is no, I don't agree with that. I think there are plenty of artists that have lyrics, you know, a Dylan or a Leonard Cohen, or just, you know, there's certain artists where you're like, no, the lyrics are just, they hit me on a level. But there's plenty of music out there where, again, the lyrics they're not going to win any kind of like prize for prose, but, you know, you pair them with the music and somehow it just works. That's how I look at it.
No, that makes sense. I agree. It's, you know, I guess I've always said that the melodies for these songs are so strong. And there's also something to be said for the phrasing, which I think like is a thing that people don't ever really think about. Is it's like the way the words fit with the melody so effortlessly. Like, I mean, I hear songs all the time where it's like, God, it just sounds like the artist is just struggling to cram the words in there somehow. And it's like people take for granted like that these songs, like they flow so effortlessly. And the phrasing is just perfect. Like the words fit with the melody so perfectly. And I think that Noel focused more on making sure that the phrasing was right, that was more important than the lyrics being smart. You know what I'm saying?
I do. Wayne, do you have any thoughts?
Well, yeah, I actually brought this up to Paul before. I've definitely talked shit about their lyrics before. And I've also brought up my feelings of Noel as a lead guitar player and finding it sometimes feels a little bit, I don't know, it sounds like he's stuck or it's a little bit dull to me. And Paul did come back with a really valid point that he is a melody. He didn't say this, but he's a melody monger. And like, that's really what his focus is. And that's what, and to his quote that you just read, like it's a really strong and valid point for him as a songwriter. Because you do always, like even if people don't know the lyrics to Oasis, which everybody seems to, you all know the melodies to Oasis.
Yeah, for sure.
And Paul, yeah, another interesting point is about the cadence and the way they come out. I never really thought about it like that. But yeah, there isn't an Oasis song I can think of where it's like, it's clunky.
Yeah, I mean, there's probably a few, but...
No, don't contradict me. I was agreeing with you.
No, I'm just saying, like, I think we have to wait until we get to the later albums to, like, get to that point. Oh, yeah. But, yeah, I think we're all on the same page. I don't know, the melodies are so strong that it's like, well, actually don't really have a lot of problems with the lyrics on Definitely Maybe.
I don't either.
It's really, I think there are some songs on Morning Glory where it's like slowly walking down the hall faster than a cannonball. It's like, all right, man, like you could have done better. But then again, that's on, you know, Champagne Supernova, which is like a massive, like everybody loves that song, you know? So it's like, well, all right, well, who cares?
Yeah. Who am I to argue?
Well, I mean, let's look at their biggest heroes, the Beatles. I mean, they had some schlocky lyrics, especially the last few records. And yeah, if you listen to like Come Together, like those lyrics on their own are just like, what the fuck is he talking about? But, you know, with the melody and the way that the song unfolds, like, I don't know, I find it to be brilliant. So
Norwegian Wood is the one that sticks out to me as the most Oasis.
Yeah, indeed. Well, now that we brought up the Beatles, I think it's worth talking about, like, has there ever been a band that has worn their influences so upfront, just like painstakingly obvious than this? I mean, to the point where, you know, they're mentioning like Yellow Submarine, that Paul alluded or mentioned that the Live Forever single is John Lennon's Home. I mean, like there was no shame when it came to them worshiping at the altar of the Beatles.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say Greta Van Fleet as a joke.
No, you're right. You're actually right.
That's seriously, I mean, I don't really think that's the thing. It's like they were such huge Beatles fans. You know, Liam was always wearing like a T-shirt with the Beatles on it or whatever, you know, back in the day. Or he'd have his like, you know, his New York shirt, which is like the same one that John Lennon wore. But I don't hear a ton of Beatles and Definitely Maybe. I mean, I
don't know that I do either. I think when you think about it in retrospect, of course, you know, I think the Beatles influence, like if I'm looking at it purely from like, if Definitely Maybe is the only record that ever existed, and, or like at that time, I think I could probably see myself kind of coming away with the sentiment of like, wow, those guys are like really into the Beatles. But when you look back over their career and everything that came after, they certainly stood on their own. I mean, well, even with all the stuff that was just kind of lifted from, I mean, Cigarettes and Alcohol is like, dude, that's a T-Rex song. Right.
Yeah, that's what I was just going to say that. It's like they have more in common with T-Rex sonically and in songwriting than they do with the Beatles, at least on Definitely Maybe. I mean, like, so it's an interesting thing because I think people don't stop and think. It's like, yeah, they were always talking about the Beatles and they're always comparing themselves to the Beatles, but I don't think they really sounded anything like the Beatles. Like, I don't really think there are any melodies on Definitely Maybe that sound like the Beatles. Like, they weren't experimenting with weird sounds like the Beatles did. Obviously, the lyrics are, I mean, yes, there are some bad Beatles lyrics, but the number of amazing Beatles lyrics far outnumber bad ones. So it's a weird thing. Like, I think we have to go a little bit further into the catalog before we can really draw Beatles comparisons. That's kind of where how I feel about that.
I was just gonna say, I mean, throw in the fact that on their third single, I think you said, they're covering I Am the Walrus. It's like,
yeah,
I mean, and it's pretty out there. I think they didn't really make any, but I hear what you're saying. Like, when I listen to the record, am I picking up on specific songs that I feel like that are, you know, bones or even Beatles inspirations? I don't think so.
There are definitely, now that I think about it, like, there are definitely some songs, and I can't think of one off the top of my head, but there are definitely like certain songs where it's like, oh, that guitar kind of sounds like George Harrison, Circle White album, but those are later Oasis albums, like not Definitely Maybe.
I don't remember what I was going to say.
I guess I also want to mention that we haven't talked about Sad Song, or wasn't Talk Tonight, like, was that a B-side from Morning Glory?
I think that was Morning Glory. Let me see. I'm just looking it up.
Talk Tonight.
Oh, yeah, that was the B-side for Some Might Say.
Oh, okay. But Sad Song, 100%, was like, I don't know where exactly that was. It like on the vinyl version of Definitely Maybe? Okay, but I think it might have been on like the vinyl version of Definitely Maybe as like a bonus track or something.
Okay, yeah, it says Japanese edition only. Sad Song and Cloudburst were...
No, okay, that's not right, though, because if you look at vinyl version, it lists Sad Song Side 2 after Columbia, which is pretty weird. Isn't that weird? I mean, I guess vinyl in 1994 was definitely, like, not an afterthought.
Yeah.
So I guess it probably... It's just an odd that they would put an extra song on just the vinyl version. That's just, I think it's a strange, that's a great song too. And it's like it's a totally deep cut. Like, it's weird. It's like weird that they didn't put it on one of the actual singles as a B-side.
I do feel like the vinyl, because you're right, like in the 90s, vinyl wasn't what it is right now. But it, you know, it certainly had a portion of the market to the point where they just didn't get rid of it, right? Like, people were still buying it to keep it in. Labels were still pressing it, right? So I think a lot of bands maybe kind of rewarded or just kind of like as a fun little extra would throw that on the... I don't know. That is very interesting. You know, how these things happen or the decisions that are made, I think, are probably different in every case, but... It's certainly something to kind of like.
So I'm curious if you guys have like what your favorite non-singles are from Definitely Maybe.
For me, it's kind of like, you know how you were having trouble putting Definitely Maybe, kind of ranking it, which, you know, you're right, it's kind of, that's an impossible task. For me, it's almost kind of hard to pick a song off this record, because to me, from top to bottom, it's fantastic. I think Diggsy's Dinner, I think, has always kind of had a special place in my heart, especially I saw Noel and Gim play a show together, like an acoustic show. And I think that's kind of when that song hit me as just like something that felt special. And, you know, it's like sometimes you hear certain songs live or it's just the moment and you kind of connect with it a little more. But that one for me, I think if I'm to pick one, a non-single, that would probably be my pick.
I tell you my least favorite?
Yes. Dixie's Dinner?
Rock and Roll Star.
Okay.
Can't stand it. It's musical theater. It could be the Jets and, you know, East Side Story. Is that the musical? And it's just like, I'm a boy and I want to be a rock.
Yeah, I get that. I've always liked that song pretty well, but I get what you're saying. I mean, it's funny that Seth said Dixie's Dinner because to me, that's like always the one that I would say just replace that with Sad Song or Fade Away or Listen Up. But like Slide Away is awesome. Bring It On Down is great. Columbia is great. Up in the Sky is great. Actually, Shaker Maker is one of my least favorite songs on the album. It's insane to me that they put that second on the album. It's just kind of not great. I don't know.
I don't know what you guys are talking about. Paul, I don't know what you're talking about Dixie's Dinner. I mean, any song that mentions lasagna four times is like a classic, right?
It was co-written by Garfield.
So, anything else, guys? So here's a little tidbit. I always kind of like to place things in a time and kind of just understand what else was happening. So I looked up what other things happened in 1994. Northridge earthquake, which was the last major earthquake in LA in January. China got the internet in 1994. Nelson Mandela becomes South Africa's first black president. The O.J. Simpson chase was in 94. Oh. I mean, some of these things feel like so ancient, you know, and it really kind of makes me think back to, it's like, oh, okay, yeah, no, this was a long time ago. Amazon was founded in 19. So when Definitely Maybe came out, you could not order a copy on Amazon and have it delivered to your house. Justin Bieber was born, as was future England keeper Jordan Pickford. So I always think it's kind of puts it in perspective as to how much time has gone by since something that we kind of all love and were aware of has came into the world.
In happy news, Michael Jackson married Lisa Marie Presley that year.
Oh, is that true?
On my birthday, May 26th.
It is very happy news.
Happy the news. Really awesome kiss at that award show. Ugh, I remember that.
Oh, yeah.
An arranged marriage.
Yeah.
Hey, so I kind of thought we were going to touch on like the reunion a little bit today.
We could touch on anything.
I read that Steve Hoffman forum. Like, I don't read Reddit, but I read that forum and there's like a very long Oasis reunion thread on there. And it's kind of amazing the number of people who are like, oh, they're obviously just doing it for the money, which I find so deeply annoying. You know, okay, one, like, Liam and Noel don't need money. And, like, another thing people love to say is, well, surprise, surprise, Noel got divorced and now Oasis is going on tour. It's like, dude does not need the money. Like, he just doesn't, you know? And I just, like, the idea that they're only doing it to get a huge paycheck is just kind of absurd to me. And on the flip side, though, it's like, God fucking forbid that a professional musician go on tour and make a ton of money. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, that's how they make their living. That's their job. And I find it offensive that people like love to make these comments and it drives me nuts. And that's not to say that there aren't some reunions that are, you know, just for the money. I guess, you know, there was a rumor that the only reason the Stone Roses reunited was because Rennie was like bankrupt. I don't know if that's true, but anyways, it always just rubs me the wrong way when I read comments about the Oasis reunion and it's like, well, they obviously just need the money. Like, what a joke. Like, really? I mean, I think Noel's worth like something like, how much is he worth? What's his net worth? You know, and I get it. That's not like liquid assets, but it's like, dude does not need money.
I mean, Wayne, if he needed money, he could sell a guitar and he'd get some money.
Sure, I think they probably made a ton of cash putting All Around the World in that cell phone ad. Well, I forget what it was for.
Yeah, they could license a bunch of songs to commercials and make money like so easily, much easier than going on a tour. So like, I just Googled it and the internet says that Noel Gallagher's net worth is estimated at $52 million. I mean, and I get it, that's not liquid assets, but it's like he doesn't need money.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. So I think there's two points here. I think you're right. I think people pointing out that something being a cash grab and that being a bad thing, we don't, I'd say most of us don't blame like a superstar athlete for signing like a $750 million contract, right? It's like, get the money where you can't, right? Like if someone's offering you that, why not, you know? And you can kind of get in the hole. Okay.
I feel like I'm the only person that ever points out how embarrassing it is for these athletes to do like these fucking Allstate commercials. Like those commercials with the guys from the Chiefs, they're embarrassing. Like I would hope that if I was, you know, those guys are probably worth way more than Noel Gallagher. And I would hope that if I was worth $100+ million, that I would not embarrass myself doing an Allstate commercial. Like, or is that what it is? State Farm, whatever.
Yeah, State Farm. Well, I'll tell you though, I mean, I don't know if this is true so much these days, but the thing that they would always mention maybe like 10 years ago was that like, the average sports star is broke within 10 years of retiring or whatever, you know. And obviously those aren't the Michael Jordans or the LeBron James or the Shohei Ohtanis of the world. But yeah, you know, I think it's hard. And part of that's living a baller lifestyle. I mean, just kind of along that same topic. I mean, I saw Walton Goggins was in a Walmart commercial. It's like,
he's been doing a lot of commercials recently.
Like, I mean, I get it, man. I mean, the guy's had a career and all of a sudden, almost overnight, he's hot. It's like, yeah, I mean, you should have been getting that money 20 years ago with how amazing you are as an actor. And so whatever, grab it now while you can. So, I mean, that's the first point. It's like, are we really going to put people down for trying to make money? But I think you're right. I don't think they need the money. Honestly, like, look, I go back to what we're talking about with, you know, Liam and Noel on their own playing moderately smaller venues than they do as Oasis. So I think more than a money situation, it's probably like just the absolute thrill of being a band of that caliber and walking out to, you know, like a Wembley Stadium or something like that, or just a major, like a Hyde Park. You know what I mean? It's just like, that's fuck the money. Like that's kind of like a high that you're not going to get from any drug or anything like that. So, I mean, look, did any of us think that Oasis would never get back together again? I guess it's easy to say that now that they have reunited, but I don't know that I ever thought that they wouldn't. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I expected it, especially like when we go back to all the other bands that have just been kind of reuniting. It just felt inevitable. Also, like, how much, like, I know they play up their hatred for each other. How much of that is true?
I mean, I think that there's definitely truth to it. Like, I think that there was I don't know how long ago it was, but Liam said some really shitty things about, like, Noel's wife. And he said it publicly. And that's not the kind of thing that people get over real easy, you know? I mean, even if it wasn't public, like, I mean, you know, I'm sure we've all had experiences with just friends who, oh, you heard that they said this shit behind their back about you. And like, you know, it really sucks. And like, I just can't imagine, I don't have any siblings, but I can't imagine having a brother and finding out that he was like talking like mad shit about my wife. You know, like, let alone in a public forum. So I think that there probably really is some.
Yeah, more than.
I mean, if you look at their initial stretch, right, especially in the 90s, They're very contentious. And to Wayne's point, it's like, oh, they're brothers. So how much of it was actually real versus the media playing it up? But, you know, to me, the thing that always sticks in my mind is like the complete major asshole move is when they were playing MTV Unplugged and Liam said that he was sick and couldn't go on. So Noel takes over the duties. And then Liam shows up in the balcony and is like heckling Noel.
And he was also
show.
Like drinking and smoking.
Yeah. So it's like, are you kidding me? Like, that's like, just from like a professional embarrassment standpoint, especially for a band that was at the point they were at when that happened, seemed pretty out of pocket, I guess, as they say.
I actually think that Liam might have been like really nervous to do that because like doing an acoustic performance is not something that I would say is in his wheelhouse, especially in the early days. Like I wouldn't be surprised if he was just like afraid that, you know, his limitations of his vocals would be exposed. And like, he doesn't really sing quietly ever.
That's true. I guess you're right. I mean, what causes anxiety or stage fright, I think is going to be different, but we're also talking about a guy that at that point had performed in front of massive crowds. And I guess I hear what you're saying, Paul, where it's like, you know, the music is louder and he can kind of just, you know, fade into that. And, you know, is there some sort of thing that he's afraid of, like being found out in an acoustic setting? I guess I could buy that.
I mean, I could be wrong, but like it strikes me as very Liam to be like to be nervous or scared of something. And instead of just being honest about it, just like puffing his chest out and trying to make himself seem like a badass by smoking and drinking and heckling his brother, you know, and just being like, I just don't want to fucking do it. I don't feel like it. It's like, yeah, maybe, or maybe you were just nervous about how you would come off in that setting.
Yeah. Wayne, would you do that to your brother?
Yeah. Nah. Of course not. No, that's crazy.
Are there any lingering thoughts that we want to talk about?
I actually think that there's a lot of, I feel like we loosened up a lot kind of halfway through. I think there's a lot of good stuff that came after you said, I think we're about to wrap up.
Yeah, no, I agree. You know, well, I think we can do a really good edit. I do think we forgot something, though. The Adidas Oasis collection. What are you guys copping?
Yeah.
What's that?
What are you guys copping from the Adidas?
Yeah, we should talk about that. Okay, I have it up here. Like, some of this shit's already sold out, and it appears as though, like, it's probably shipping from the UK because the prices are all in pounds, so I'm sure any of... Well, okay, can I switch to... Yes, you can switch to US, so let's see.
I mean, the bucket hats are sold out, gentlemen, so I hope you weren't...
Okay, so I don't think if you switch to US, you don't even get the Oasis shit. So like it probably is shipping all from the UK, so you're probably paying crazy prices. But I mean, I looked at all this stuff. I kind of like the tour coach jacket, which is sold out, the black one.
Yeah, that one's,
you know, I feel like, okay, this is me being I guess just, I think Adidas will probably restock some of the stuff. Like if there's money to be made, sure. Like why wouldn't they just get it? But maybe not. I mean, maybe they're gonna stick to like a limited nature, but like, god damn.
Did you guys see the images from the pop-up shops that are starting to appear in the UK?
No, I didn't see these.
So like I saw some of that shit today, and it just like today is like the first day, and I was like, god damn, they have vinyl reissues of all the studio albums that are like special 2025 tour editions with like a OBI strip that says like 2025, like tons of t-shirts, like anything, like water bottles, like anything you can think of.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, I think if you're in the UK, you would be good to get all kinds of shit. But like looking at this Adidas site, there's nothing on here I would really buy. I think I would feel like a poser wearing a lot of this stuff. It'd be like, okay, Mr. UK. Like, I don't know. I just,
Mr. UK.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. UK, what do you say about that, Wayne? I mean, I think track jackets, for anyone who loves the type of music, track jackets are always going to be in stock, right? Everyone could use a good track jacket.
I suppose. Like, I kind of like, these all seem to have that huge circular logo on the back. And I would prefer one that did not have that.
Yeah.
Sorry, I got.
Yeah. I'm with you.
I like the long sleeve tee. I could go for that. But that's about it. Like, because that feels like merch you would buy at a show. And I'm not going to buy merch not from a show, I don't think.
Yeah, no.
Also, don't want to look like a football player that plays for 08.
Yeah, that's like, that's the thing for me. It's like, all this shit is football culture.
Dude, I mean, I gotta be honest. Like, I hate bucket hats, and the fact that the bucket hats are sold out. It's like, fuck, like that 90s fashion really is back, huh?
I don't like bucket hats either. I actually have a friend who recently has taken to wearing like the most hideous bucket hat I've ever seen. And like, it's now his thing. He just wears it every time I see him. And I'm like, dude, no, I haven't said anything, but it's like,
well, he's going to find out because I'm going to.
Yeah. Yeah. All right, guys. Well, this was great. All right, guys. Good chat.